You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 30 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host Kevin Pelton.
I'm Tristan Caracino.
And we are coming to you live from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
And a big week in football.
All kinds
of football.
It is. We got a lot going on, a lot to get to. And to celebrate the fact that this is the Apple Cup coming up this week.
But wait, you had a special announcement before this.
No, I wanted to mention the beer first.
Okay.
And then we'll get to the special announcement. I went down to visit our friends at the Brewmaster's Tap Room.
Our good friends at the Brewmaster's Tap Room.
Right here in Cascade.
It's Cascade. I would go with Renton, Washington, but okay.
Right here in Renton, Washington.
Home of the Super Bowl 48 champion, Seattle Seahawks.
Offering a fine selection of Washington microbrews, like fairly obscure microbrews, like 5 minutes from your house.
Yeah, no, that's the craziest thing about it. The beer's great, but its proximity to my house in suburban Renton, Washington is the great thing about it.
It's pretty outstanding. So anyway, for today, I decided that the appropriate tribute would be to get some beer from Ellensburg. Because as any fan of the Huskies or the Cougars knows, if you're going to get between Seattle and Pullman, you're going to have to go through Ellensburg.
Okay. That makes sense. But no Clallam?
I don't know about Clallam breweries. So the main brewery in Ellensburg is the Iron Horse Brewery. They're pretty well known at this point.
I'm going to say not a fan.
I like their offerings. Our mother's favorite beer in the world comes from Iron Horse. Yeah, the Irish Death. But this is a new location, the Whipsaw Brewing Company, a husband and wife team that have been home brewing for the last 2 decades and recently opened up their own brew pub in downtown Ellensburg.
Really? What type of beer is this that we're drinking from Whipsaw Brewing Company?
This is the Stump Blower IPA, full of bright and bountiful hop flavor. Lime, papaya, strawberry, and kiwi aromas are here at full strength. A plethora of lemon flavors topped with mint and orange marmalade carry through to a bracingly bitter finish. Wow. And that's a really weird description.
Yeah, there's way too much stuff in this beer.
Not exactly what I was expecting, but I
did
also
want to... Did you say it was called Stump Blower IPA?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's apparently the husband was like a logger, so that's the... Hence a logger. Not that, but one of the locations you can find Whipsaw beers... At the Yellow Church Cafe in Ellensburg.
Oh, of course.
If you're stopping there on your way between Seattle and Pullman. So,
which you should do if you are.
Absolutely, you should. Just like
our boy Vince?
Yes,
Vince Staples?
Just like Vince Staples. This is pretty good.
It's not that good.
It's not that citrusy, but it's smooth and very drinkable.
Our mom compared this beer. If we can talk about our mom and her beer taste from Ellensburg, she went to college there, so I feel like it has to be mentioned.
I suppose so.
Our mom compared this beer to Mac and Jack's, which she calls Mac and Jack, because it's the only beer that she's aware of.
It's not the only beer she's aware of. It's the only microbrew.
She's also aware of Irish Death.
that's true. So I guess there are a couple.
Every beer that is not Irish Death or Rainier tastes like Mac and Jack.
Those are the three categories. All right. As you alluded to earlier, have a little something that I want to play for you and for the listeners, and I'm going to get you to react your thoughts
to it. Oh, my God. I have no idea what this is, but I love when you play audio clips.
So last week, our friends at The Starters, our good friends at The Starters,
okay,
the show on NBA TV, they also do the weekly Friday Drop podcast, and here is a segment from last Friday's podcast.
More of the Stump Blower.
This is a fun one. If you guys were in an Anchorman-style rumble, what other NBA TV shows / podcast hosts would you guys be most scared of? That's from Greg Casoli. He tweeted that one in. Who would frighten us in an Anchorman-style rumble?
Ryan Russell looks like a big man.
Oh yeah. He's got guns.
How about Shaquille O'Neal? Or just that doesn't count?
Yeah, no.
Yeah, I mean...
Unpodcasty. Yeah. He doesn't... Well, he does have a podcast, actually.
Yeah, I would be petrified because I always think... It's the quiet ones that you got to be afraid of, right? That they're the ones that snap and go crazy. Kevin Pelton. Kevin Pelton would kill a man. I'm 100% he has. and will again. Yeah, because
100%?
He's so soft-spoken. He's so intelligent. He's got the number. He'd be bludgeoning you with like numbers, like PR to the face.
So what, you think Schumann would be his tag team partner?
Schumann, yeah, maybe. Yeah, the numbers guys, man. They play the angles.
Numbers guys. Did he just say that Kevin Pelton has killed a man and will again?
I'm pretty sure that's what he said. I don't, which I don't know how Skeets knew.
Were you aware that were you listening to this live and then heard that Kevin Pelton will kill a man?
I was not, actually. I was busy recording a podcast, chatting, you know, usual stuff on a Friday. And I got a text from my friend Ben Golliver, who alerted me to listen to the 36-minute mark of the Starters Drop podcast.
One of the questions in your chat should have been, have you killed a man and will you again?
You know, I think someone may have dropped a reference to this at some point,
but you
and I hadn't
no
heard
idea.
It yet, and I didn't know what it was referring to.
Trying to think what the closest that you've come to killing a man is.
Well,
aside from when you're in traffic and get angry.
I mean, the only real fights I've ever gotten into are with you.
With me, yeah, for sure.
The closest aside from that is once we were at a bar, what was that, Goldie's on 45th. And
you almost killed a man?
No, I did not almost kill a man. Someone threatened to rip my throat out.
Oh, I remember that.
Well, I was like completely expressionless, didn't say anything, was just kind of like standing there.
Yeah, that's how you know that you're terrifying, is because you didn't react to it.
Exactly.
That's how you know that you're going to bludgeon him with numbers.
It is the silent ones. It is the silent ones. So.
Oh, wait, somebody threatened to rip your throat out at Goldie's. I remember you talking about this. Yeah.
Which
it was also a traumatizing
thing you can
moment
do
for
outside
you.
Of the movie Roadhouse. Well, I mean, I definitely thought I was getting hit. I definitely thought that.
Thought you were going down.
And I have no way of defending myself, since, again, the closest I've ever come to being in a fight is with you. And it was probably more wrestling than actually throwing punches or anything.
I'm trying to think of the most violent altercation that we've had was, especially in the last, like, 15 years, was one time when we were playing Monopoly. Do you remember this?
Well,
I was bludgeoning you with numbers.
Oh, I suppose so. Like dollar bills?
Yeah, dollar bills, y'all.
Yeah,
I was bludgeoning you with numbers, and you couldn't take it, and you stood up and pushed me in the face.
I don't play Monopoly anymore.
That was the last time that you've ever played Monopoly.
Swear off Monopoly.
I'm trying to think of the most violent fight that we had one fight on my birthday in, like, 2003. Do you remember that?
Yeah, that sounds about right.
I think
the most recent fight we had was, there was one time we were watching a Sonics game at our cousin's house.
I got into
a fight. But to me, the most violent one is, like, I think I like may have slammed your head or something on your birthday in, like, 1994.
We were playing soccer?
No, that was a different thing.
That was a different thing.
This is like we had people over after going to a Mariners game. And
you slammed my head on the ground?
So, I don't
know. Wow, you have killed a man, and you will again.
Fortunately, you are still alive to do this podcast. And the only fighting we now do is our verbal sparring. Each week on the
podcast.
We'll
see about that.
Yeah.
If the microphones get dropped and you hear scuffling in the background, that's Kevin Pelton killing a man.
I think,
alert the authorities.
Can we be careful with how much we say Kevin Pelton killing a man? I'm getting a little uncomfortable.
Has killed a man.
I mean, you never know. Thanksgiving can get a little out of hand.
Yeah, no, I would expect it to.
You would expect no less.
Yeah. Yeah, if you don't, I think you should turn the threat to ripping somebody's throat around.
Yeah, okay.
You should take that one back.
Perhaps if politics comes up at Thanksgiving, you never know what might happen. Something I did want to mention, by the way, to completely change direction.
this is an official confession.
No.
Doing it here on this live podcast.
I've had in my notes, like, each week that I am supposed to mention that we're now on Stitcher. And I have never, always failed to do so. So this is going to be my time. If you are listening to this off of the website, and wish to receive it on a weekly basis, subscribe, have it automatically come into your phone. iTunes is a great option.
People understand how Stitcher works. Okay.
Stitcher, we're also there now, so you can sign up there. Those are your ways to do that.
Great.
So I got in the plug. Now should we talk about sports?
Very nice. I don't know. I feel like I like the animosity that was going on. I liked reliving the fights that we've had. It made me feel good about days of yore. Rarely do we fight anymore.
It's true. People are upset. They wish we would fight much more. Not physically, but we wish we would, like, argue more on the podcast. So it'd be more like real life.
We should record the podcast not after sporting events, but during the most high-pressure moments of them. That's when we should record it.
Our takes on the podcast would be too hot. As we know, we've had to like make a rule that we can't confront each other with takes that we have.
The take is usually we're going to lose.
Oh, it's always
in the first quarter. When I saw that the Seahawks didn't defer on Sunday's game, I was like, the game's over.
Yeah. Huge trouble now.
That's my take.
But we really do have a lot of sports to get to this week.
Okay.
Do you want to start with
this? Pretty good, by the way.
Yeah.
What did you call it?
What did I call it?
Yeah, stump blow?
Stump blower, I believe.
Guys, not that far off. Should we start with the Sounders?
We should start with the Sounders because they are playing in, as we record this,
18
and a half hours.
Okay. 18 and a half hours.
Yeah.
Is this the we're going to discuss what may be the most important Apple Cup ever? Is this the most important match in Sounders history?
No, because I would still say when the Sounders played the Galaxy in the conference finals.
No, I disagree. No,
that's our new podcast format now. Yeah. We're going to
everything. Just wait. I'm going to wait and find out your take on whether this is the most important Apple Cup ever and violently disagree. It's going to come to blows.
Oh, embrace debate. No, I would say that when the Sounders faced the Galaxy in the Western Conference finals, because that's a rivalry, number one. Number two, they had a chance to become the first team ever to record the treble in U.S. soccer.
That's never happened in U.S. soccer.
Winning the U.S. Open Cup, the Supporters' Shield, the regular season championship, and then the MLS Cup. Now, no one has done it. The Sounders prevented FC Dallas from doing it this very year. So this doesn't have quite the same stakes. But you can say now in hindsight, because the Sounders lost to the Galaxy, like that game, those matches weren't that important. But at the time, they were the most.
Didn't matter at all.
But now they have an actual chance to win the MLS Cup. So now these are, they're by that definition, the most important.
Okay. You came around to agreeing with me by the end.
By a ridiculous definition, they are the most important.
So let's talk about the Colorado Rapids. A lot of USMNT, current and former USMNT players on this Colorado Rapids team.
Well, most notably Tim Howard, as we discussed last week on the podcast. In the match the USMNT lost to Mexico, helping set up Jurgen Klinsmann getting fired.
Wow, Tim Howard did it?
No. Oh. Tim Howard getting injured did it. That's what I'm saying here.
Okay.
If he didn't get injured, Jurgen would still be coaching onward.
Is it true that Bruce Arena is the most likely successor?
That is all the reporting.
Wow.
So this probably good news for the Sounders. Galaxy are losing Steven Gerrard and who's their other designated player whose name is now slipping out of my
head. From Ireland.
Yes.
Yep.
Who is actually much better than Steven Gerrard, but for some reason his name is completely escaping. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so yeah, the Galaxy could be significantly weakened, but Howard, because of that injury, out for this series. As we discussed last week, his backup, Zach McMath, will step in, and he started the first 17 games of the season before Howard came over from playing in England, and Colorado went 9-3-5 in those games and allowed only 0.76 goals per game. Which went up to 1.12 after Howard's arrival. Now, one of the reasons, though, that that's not quite a fair comparison is because at the same time Howard came in, Jermaine Jones, who's been a mainstay for the USMNT and a Jurgen Klinsmann favorite, suffered an injury, and he was out basically the entire second half of the season. Came back and played a little bit in their final match of the regular season, but now is pretty much fully fit, played a bunch for the USMNT, and should be very effective for them in kind of a defensive midfield role playing in front of their back four.
Jermaine Jones.
Yeah.
I mean, I would say the comparison between these two goalies, I would never say that I felt confident that the Sounders were going to win a match because of the goalie. And also, like, I would imagine that a 0.4 per match goal differential between these two goalies, I would almost never blame the goalie for that.
Right. It's pretty random. So it's not that big of a deal. But it is important because Colorado is going to win if they win this match series.
Wow. Making a bold prediction already.
They will win with defense. They had the third lowest goal total in MLS this season with 39, but allowed the fewest goals at 32. So they're really heavily dependent on keeping clean sheets. They had, I believe, 8-1-0 wins this season, which was the most in MLS. And their offensive attack could be even further weakened against the Sounders tomorrow because they are likely to be out with Skeltsen-Gashi. I've got the pronunciation guide in there. I still think I may have gotten it wrong.
He's a designated player for them?
Yes, he's their designated player.
Had you heard of him before this very moment?
No.
Okay.
He was the one who scored the equalizer in their series with where they eliminated the Galaxy in the conference semifinals.
What country is Skeltsen?
You know, I didn't write that down, so I'm not sure. I will have to look it up.
Okay.
But he scored from 39 yards out, one of the goals of the year. That was the only goal they scored in that two-game aggregate series, but went to extra time and then eventually won a shootout to advance ahead of the Galaxy.
So he's
Albanian.
Really?
Yeah.
So this is the type of match that Colorado is not going to be playing soccer.
I mean, they'll be trying to hit on the counter, and for sure.
They're going to be sitting back, and the Sounders may dominate possession through the match.
I think that's quite possible.
It's very likely that the Sounders have possession 60-40 or something like that, right? They may get a lot of shots, but Colorado's goal is just not to give up any goals, particularly in the road match.
Absolutely. I mean, that would be a huge win for them. I mean, if this was a scoreless draw, they would be really thrilled with that. But Pablo Mastroni, their manager talked about how they want to try to keep Nicolò Lodero out of the middle of the park. That's their goal. Lodero, who was named MLS Newcomer of the Year on Monday.
Oh, Player of the Year.
I mean, only play in the second half. Hard to win that award.
He's like Brady.
Brady still only missed a quarter of the season.
So to keep Nicolò Lodero out of the middle of the park.
Yeah. And now with the Sounders' attack could also be compromised because of health. We haven't really heard much on Jordan Morris. We know he's been limited in training.
He was at the Seahawks game yesterday with Brian Schmetzer.
We do know that. That is true.
Looked fine, I can report.
Well, it's a lot easier to walk around at the Seahawks game than it is to run around for 90 minutes. I mean, I could see a scenario where he plays but not all 90 minutes. I don't know whether that's starting and playing 60 or coming off the bench and playing 30. I think that's more realistic probably than him playing a full 90 in this one, especially with the second leg. The interesting thing about this series, usually in the playoffs, they go Sunday. But because of the fact that the Seahawks were hosting a game on Sunday, they could not do that. And they're playing Tuesday-Sunday, a pretty short
turnaround.
Oh,
that's why they're playing Tuesday-Sunday?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. So, you know, without Gashi, they've got Kevin Doyle as their other forward. He scored 6 goals this year. He's an Irish international. And then it could mean a larger role for an old friend of ours, Sebastian Letou.
Saba.
It's always good to see Sebastian Letou, although I hope he does not score.
Is he still good?
No, he's coming off the bench for them. I mean, he had a really nice run in Philadelphia for a while and then has kind of bounced around a little bit. But they have several former Sounders. Also, Michael Azira and Marco Papa. Papa is questionable in this game. And then the Sounders, other than Morris, their health is looking pretty good. Ramon Torres, who missed, I think, both of the games against Dallas with a hamstring injury. He played for Panama during the international break. He seems good to go. And Andreas Ivanchitz, who's missed several games now, also should be back for this one.
So Morris is a big question mark. Everybody else should be back,
yep,
obviously, except for Clint. This could be the type of series, particularly in this first match, where if the Sounders can even get a single goal, it could be huge for the entire matchup.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, the realistic expectation here is a 1-0 win at home.
That's the realistic expectation?
Yeah.
Or the realistic hope?
The realistic hope would be maybe to get 2 goals. But
the realistic hope would be 100-0.
It's not a realistic hope. I mean, what the Sounders did to Dallas, like, that's not a realistic scenario against A, this Colorado defense, and B, with Jordan Morris's injury.
But they would be in a good position. I mean, Colorado does not have the most formidable attack. If they were to win 1-0 at home, they would be in a very good position, right?
A pretty solid position, yeah. And I think I saw that they are the gambling favorites at this point to win MLS Cup, which is
really
fascinating.
I like that you call it MLS Cup.
I mean, that's the name of it.
They're the favorites to win overall?
Yeah.
And they have a chance to host the final.
They do. If Montreal wins in the Eastern Conference Finals, they would host the final.
Okay, I was assuring Mrs. Fantasy Genius about how few sporting events there are remaining in the rest of the year. Don't tell her that there's a possibility of that.
your secret is safe with me.
Don't tell her how to listen to this podcast either.
No, I will not tell her how to listen to it on Stitcher or iTunes.
So we're looking for a 1-0 victory.
That's, I think, the goal on Tuesday.
I mean, a victory of any kind is the goal on Tuesday.
By the way, the bummer about this series is the return leg on Sunday kicks off at 1 p.m. exactly opposite the Seahawks game. So get ready. Hopefully you can prepare your true
TV
setup.
This is the one time that the Seahawks go to the East Coast and play a 1 p.m. start, and it happens to be exactly opposite of Sounders, but the most important Sounders match ever.
Yes.
I mean, hypothetically, in this scenario, it actually is the most important Sounders match ever.
Yes. So that's a bummer.
It's a perfect MLS moment.
It's a very perfect MLS moment.
Good for them. The market share.
Especially that it's being played in late November. If it snows in Denver, yeah. that just adds to the most perfect.
There has to be a good chance of that, right?
I'll have to look at the forecast.
Okay, pull up the forecast, and we'll do... Are we doing percentage chances of victory? Because it's kind of a complicated...
In the series.
We're going to do a percentage, because we won't be talking again before.
We will not.
We might be talking again, but we're not going to talk about Thunders before.
Yes.
Probably a 55% chance.
I was going to say 60. I'm reasonably optimistic.
Winning the series.
Yeah, I mean, I do think as long as Jordan Morris plays, the Sounders are the better team. And I think they're a little bit better positioned with the health. Supposed to be partly cloudy, but a high of 47 on Sunday.
Oh, sounds lovely.
61 on Saturday. Denver weather is really weird.
Yeah, it should be snowing right now, Denver.
It's snowing. It could be snowing currently, according to this.
I mean, it could be snowing currently anywhere.
No, I guess not until 3 in the morning. But it realistically could be signed.
But there's a better than 50% chance of winning this series. And I think
the Sounders are the favorites.
Just the way that Colorado plays. I mean, I understand defense being important in a two-game series like this. But honestly, if you just give up one goal, it could be so huge.
Yeah, I mean,
just going to be... If the Sounders score, if they do win 1-0, the pressure on them to score a goal is so huge. And they might not have the attack to be able to do so.
Yes, it set up a very interesting second leg.
Which we won't see. We'll hear about it on the George Michael Sports Machine.
No,
after.
We'll see. It'll just be 2 minutes behind on my tiny computer.
The laptop that we don't pay attention to.
I pay attention. Just not as much attention.
I can't wait. I literally can picture it right there with the laptop set up next. There's the giant TV with the football game on and the laptop with the soccer game right next to it.
Yep.
Okay. Well, MLS.
Yep. Husky basketball.
Should we talk Blazers for one quick second?
Sure.
The Blazers right now are reeling, would you describe them that way? As much as you could be at the beginning of the season?
They're not as much reeling after they beat Brooklyn pretty handily on Sunday. And now we'll be traveling to New York to face them tonight.
From Brooklyn to New York?
Yeah, it's a long trip. It's extensive travel.
How long is that flight?
Damian Lillard had some sort of event. I don't know if you saw anything about this on Twitter. He had some sort of rap event tonight.
Really?
Yeah.
That's what we should talk about instead.
I forget who was the special guest. Let me see if I can look that up.
Oh, was it a member of Mobb Deep? Was it Raekwon the Chef?
I don't think so.
You don't think it was either of those? Was it a Boogie with the Hoodie? You gave me a look like that's not a real person. I assure you it's a real artist.
It was Talib Kweli.
Oh, Talib Kweli. Okay, that would have been my fourth guess.
Stop. Yes. Yeah, I mean...
That's nice that they have a day off between Brooklyn and New York.
It is, yeah. It's nice to have that in the city. So, Al-Farouq Aminu's injury has really hurt the Blazers. Their defense was not great, I would say, with Aminu, and they had a lot of wins that were really kind of unimpressive early in the season, like coming from behind to win at Denver, coming from behind to win at home against Denver. That may have been after Aminu was injured.
A lot of unimpressive victories against
Denver.
Narrowly
beating Phoenix on election night. So like a number of these games where it's like they got the win.
That's all I was paying attention to on election night.
Yes. But you were like, that's actually kind of troubling for them going forward. And then since Aminu has been out, they've been the worst defense in the league by a substantial margin.
Really?
So they've tried a few different players in his spot, and I wouldn't say that anyone has really worked.
Who've they
for
tried?
Them. They started with Myers Leonard. I think Noah Vonleh may have gotten one start there. They played small with Alan Crabb a little bit and moved Maurice Harkless down to the four, who is playing quite well. Harkless, that's probably been the best development of the season so far. And then more recently, they've been playing Ed Davis in a kind of a two-center attack.
How has Evan Turner been so far?
Oh, not good at all.
You hate Evan Turner.
I don't hate Evan Turner. I don't hate Evan Turner. I want to be clear about that. He is last in the league in ESPN's Real and Plus Minus when the first update came out last Friday.
Is he really?
He also has spent much of the year last in my wins above replacement player stat.
Oh, my God. You hate Evan Turner.
I don't hate Evan Turner.
Sorry, the stats hate Evan Turner.
That's not inaccurate.
You're going to bludgeon him with stats.
No. Hell, maybe not. Yeah, I can't rule that out.
He's got a guaranteed contract. He's fine. I mean, no matter how much you bludgeon him with stats, he's good.
He's going to play better.
He's making a lot of money.
He's going to play better, but it has not been good so far. They've been outscored by about 16 points per 100 possessions with Evan Turner on the court.
Wow. But so things are... How long is Al-Farouq Aminu out?
You know, a few weeks. So, I mean, it's not like a season-ending injury or anything. And the good news is, like I said, they did win a lot of these games where they weren't that impressive, and those count in the standings. So, you know, I think they're still looking solid as far as making the playoffs and that sort of thing. But, you know, if you were someone who thought that they were going to... I mean, I guess the other good news is the Northwest Division is still very much up for grabs. They're a half game back of Oklahoma City right now. Utah has really been hit hard by injuries, has, as usual, lost a ton of close games. So they so Portland has been outscored so far by 4 points per game.
Yeah.
Oklahoma City, or Utah, rather, has been plus 0.9, and Portland is a game ahead of them in the standings.
Huh.
Which is not supposed to work that way. Also, Utah's played 10 road games out of their 15 so far. So I think they're still the heavy favorites in the division.
Are people using this as evidence that you're wrong about Utah because you had an aggressive prediction for them?
No.
Okay.
I mean, my prediction ultimately wasn't that aggressive. I think, you know, most people generally agreed they were the favorites in the Northwest.
But it's a wide-open Northwest division.
Yeah.
Okay, and then what about Husky basketball?
All right, so things look a lot less dark than they did a week ago.
Just a little less dark.
I think a lot less dark. Okay. We definitely thought there was a real chance of them winning one of the last two games.
Losing one of the last two games.
And they did not. They beat Cal State Fullerton pretty comfortably by 16 points. And then
that game was not as comfortable as the final.
All right, that's true. They pulled away late against Cal State Fullerton. Yeah.
There were a lot of moments where, I mean, you were saying after the game that winning by 16, basically equaling what Ken Pomeroy had predicted them to win by,
yes,
is bad. And I retorted, they need to do more than that because Ken Pomeroy predicts them to be 13-16 or something like that, right?
I feel like I had the exact same conversation without you yesterday, but okay.
Okay, you apparently are having the exact same conversation every single day.
It's the only conversation to have about UW basketball. No, the other conversation to have is how amazing Markelle Fultz is.
That's a good conversation, too. And that's how that game ended. But the thing that I retorted with is they won the game. Because it looked like a very real possibility during that Cal State Fullerton game that the Huskies, I mean, they choked early in the second half and lost the lead that they had built up.
They did. But then on Sunday, they faced Northern Arizona, and that game, it was a little worryingly close in the first half, but then they ended up winning by 34. So that was the most impressive performance of the season on Sunday.
But also, as we've discussed on this very podcast, Northern Arizona is one of the worst teams in the country.
It is, but still, you don't necessarily expect to beat anyone by 34.
I mean, okay.
The KenPom projection in that one was to win by 20.
Do you think Western looked at that game and was like, we're definitely better than Northern Arizona?
Oh, yeah. they are. I'm pretty confident.
Western was like, bring on Northern Arizona.
The other worrying thing, by the way, is that happened was that Yale scored 38 points against Virginia.
I've rationalized the hell out of that one.
Slower pace.
Yep, slower pace.
Much slower pace. And then Virginia is the number 4 ranked team in KenPom. I don't know where they are in the actual
like
polls.
Number 8 or something.
Yeah.
Virginia's good, though.
They are.
We're not comparing ourselves to Virginia.
No.
Okay, so what's going on for the Huskies this week?
So we should talk a little more about Markelle Fultz, what he did last week. So he followed up the 30-point opener with 35 against Cal State Fullerton. Synergy tweeted that he's like the most efficient player in the country on a per-play basis. And then against Northern Arizona, he only had like 17-7-7.
Yeah, that's kind of the amazing thing about Markelle Fultz.
That was an off night for him.
Is we knew that Markelle Fultz was good, but we didn't know necessarily how efficient he would be.
Right. I mean, I had a little bit of concern about that based on the way he played in the FIBA U18 championship with Michael Porter over the summer, because it seemed like he struggled to make outside shots in that tournament. And so far, he is not struggling to make outside shots at all this
year. Really?
Yeah, I mean, he's he was, I think also in that synergy thing was that he's shooting better than 50% on above the break three-pointers, so not from the corners. And he is 7 of 14 overall from three-point range this year and shooting 77% for on two-point attempts.
And also just some of the plays that he makes, especially at the end of that Cal State Fullerton game, some of the plays that Markelle Fultz made are like, okay, this person's clearly better than any Husky basketball player that we've probably ever seen.
I'm not going to ready to say he's clearly better than Brandon Roy.
But some of the plays that he makes are plays that Brandon Roy could not make.
Oh, yeah. And he's doing this as a freshman. Brandon Roy was doing like, that as a senior.
He makes passes like Tony Roten, but almost never throws the ball into the crowd.
It's true. He also makes layups.
And also has a high field goal percentage. Yeah, he's like the perfect version of Tony Roten.
There was like a little bit of me that was like, man, what if Markelle Fultz just isn't that good statistically and I've got to like spend the whole year explaining why my stats don't like this guy who is at UW?
You know you're not going to have to do that.
It's not a concern of mine right now. Like, the schedule is going to get a lot harder. We'll find out more about him, but he's amazing.
Can we rationalize for one quick second? Because that's what we do on this podcast.
We are. I mean, hopefully not. We don't have to do too much of that, but yes.
I mean, we happen to cheer for a lot of pretty good teams, but especially, yeah, look at that. Man, Sounders, Huskies, and Seahawks right now.
Yeah.
And then also Husky basketball. But if we can rationalize for one quick second, that loss to Yale, granted they should not have given up as many points as they did, it was a fluky loss. It was hopefully maybe the one loss that Husky basketball will have in the preseason, and they just happened to have it early.
At home?
Yeah. They had these losses.
Because they're going to have several losses on the road.
Sure, but I'm saying the one preseason loss.
The bad loss.
Yeah. Where they lose to the one team that they shouldn't have lost. And in this game, it wasn't one individual player going off. It wasn't a Kay Felder or somebody like that. Who are the people in the past?
Nate Walters.
Oh, yeah. I knew there were some white guys in there.
Jameel Warney.
It wasn't one of those games. It just happened to be every single time that the Huskies blocked a shot, which was often, Yale somehow scored.
Hit a three. Yeah. They got more points.
So it was a fluky loss, and maybe it wasn't the death knell of this Husky basketball season.
We can hope.
So anyway, what's coming up for them this week?
So on Tuesday night, tonight is, if you're listening to this when it comes out, they will host Long Beach State.
That's a loss, guaranteed loss.
Yeah, you mentioned that when we talked before the season, like, oh no, I hope they're not playing Long Beach State. And of course they were. Long Beach State.
I think I said, God help us if they play Long Beach State.
So the Huskies actually didn't play Long Beach State in the regular season last year, but they did play them in the first round of the NIT, where they won 107-102 in one of the wilder games you can imagine, because these are both up-tempo, fast-paced teams.
I can imagine a lot wilder games than the UW Long Beach State NIT game.
I understand what you're saying.
I watched the NBA Finals last year, Western Conference Finals. I can imagine a lot of sporting events wilder than this NIT game. But anyway.
Now we're fighting, for real. From a stylistic standpoint, these two teams are going to get up and down. Long Beach State, as you know, coached by former Gonzaga coach Dan Monson, and they always schedule this really crazy, difficult non-conference schedule where they play a bunch of the best teams in the country.
And UW.
Yes. So far, their schedule has been, they played like a D2 team in their opener, but since then they've played at Wichita State, at North Carolina, at Louisville, at UCLA, and lost those games by a combined 132 points. So this does not seem to be as good of a Long Beach State team as last year.
I mean, those are pretty good teams, but yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they are very good teams. But they graduated two starters from last year. It looks like they're down a little bit, but they're still probably going to beat UW.
we can both agree. Guaranteed victory.
That is Tuesday night. They are, and Ken Pomeroy ranks them 157, down from 107 last year when they went 20-15, and I believe won the Big West in the regular season, but then lost in the conference tournament, which is why they were in the NIT.
And this is in Seattle.
Yes.
Okay.
So then after that, the Huskies will travel to Las Vegas for a two-game tournament this Friday and Saturday. On Friday, they face Western Kentucky, who's coached by former Mississippi State coach Rick Stansberry.
Do we play him in the NCAA tournament?
Yes. Jarvis Venardo was on the team at that point. Yeah.
The first ever Sounders game.
Yes.
Yeah.
So he's in his first year at Western Kentucky, and I think he's already pulling in a bunch of like really impressive recruits for Western Kentucky, but that won't help them now. So far, they have home wins over Alabama State and Jacksonville State. Then they lost by 21 at Belmont. is their season so far. Their leading scorer is, oddly enough, former Wazoo wing Q Johnson.
Yeah, I remember him.
Who transferred there this year. And the thing to note about this team is that they're making 46% of their threes. So that's a little bit worrying as a UW fan to me. Still, on a neutral court, this is a game the Huskies should be favored to win. Ken Pomeroy rates Western Kentucky 194th in the country, which is down from where they started the year. It is a game the Huskies should win.
If they were to beat Western Kentucky, who do they play after that?
So they would then they will either play the winner or the loser of the other's game on this side of the bracket, which is TCU against UNLV, which is hosting this tournament at Thomas and Mack Center on their campus. And even though it's being played in Las Vegas, I'd say TCU is a pretty comfortable favorite in that game. Ken Pomeroy has them winning 2/3 of the time. And what that was, if the Huskies were to play TCU, that would set up the fascinating scenario where the Huskies would play TCU two games in a row. Because next Wednesday, they travel to play at TCU.
A neutral site and away game series against TCU.
I mean, not quite as weird as they played Texas in two neutral sites last year.
Yeah.
But this would be consecutive games. There were games
China
in between.
And, like, Barbados?
the Bahamas, the not Bahamas. Barbados, but yes.
Okay, those are definitely the same thing.
Many time zones away.
Wait, those are many time zones away?
Yes. No, China and the Bahamas.
Okay.
Not Barbados and the Bahamas.
I was willing to believe anything there, but okay.
So UNLV is struggling. They're down a little bit, and they changed coaches last year. They hired Marvin Menzies, who was at New Mexico State, to take over that team. But TCU, intriguingly, so the Huskies scheduled this home with TCU when Trent Johnson, who used to be an assistant at UW, is from Seattle, was the head coach.
Stanford coach, yeah.
And TCU came up last year, and UW drilled them by like 30 in maybe one of their most impressive performances of the season. After the year Trent Johnson got fired, and TCU somehow found the money to go out and hire Jamie Dixon.
Yeah, what happened? Pitt. Am I reading this correctly? Did he get fired by Pitt?
He just left Pitt for TCU. Yeah. So they built a new arena. They're putting a bunch of money into the program, and they have been pretty good. They look pretty good so far.
That is recruiting violations waiting to happen.
Your words, not mine. So they've been really good so far this season. Ken Pomeroy rates them 64th in the country, and they would be, you know, a solid favorites over UW.
Yeah, we can't beat a Jamie Dixon coach team.
Didn't we beat Jamie Dixon?
I think we did. Maybe we lost close.
We lost one of those games at the buzzer, but I think we won the other game. I don't know. I'd have to go back and look that up.
I can't believe this. Jamie Dixon, Pitt was like a legit top 20 program.
I think there were some concerns about his job security there, and then just a lucrative offer. So yeah, it was a surprising move, to say the least.
Wow.
But it was a move that happened.
What was the thing when Gary Anderson, right, left Wisconsin to go coach Oregon State?
Yes.
Yeah, that's what that feels like to me.
That sounds about right.
Except maybe more successful.
Let's see here. I guess, I don't know, I thought that was a home and home with Pitt, but Pitt won 75-74 at UW in 2008.
I can't remember that. They had some good players on that team.
I think they might have had DeJuan Blair on that team.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, DeJuan Blair, Sam Young, so not that surprising in hindsight. So anyway, that's the week for Husky basketball. And the weird thing about this tournament they're playing in the Global Sports Classic is none of these games are televised. Which is hard to conceive.
They really could not get a camera into the building.
apparently they're going to be streamed on the UNLV website, is what I've read.
Great.
So we'll see about that.
Well, wait, what was the first one?
That's Friday at 5 p.m. is the first game, and then Saturday, the time will depend on whether they win or lose.
Okay, so it would be after the Apple Cup.
Yes. We'll not be competing with that.
And the Apple Cup.
Well, should we talk about the Seahawks first and then finish with the Apple Cup?
Sure.
I think that makes more sense. Because the Apple Cup is definitely the main event this weekend. Seahawks, a toast. They won the DVOA Bowl. And not just won, left no doubt.
Dominated the DVOA Bowl. We don't have updated DVOA rankings, right? But we know who's going to be number one this week.
Yeah, that's the downside of recording on Monday, is those aren't out yet. But it seems likely that the Seahawks played well enough, especially going head-to-head against the Eagles.
We've got a DVOA crystal ball and know that Philadelphia is not going to be number one.
I don't know if I would say that we have a DVOA crystal ball, but okay.
We have a DVOA crystal ball, and it always says Seahawks. It does. Sometimes Eagles.
Actually, it has always been right then, every single year. Seahawks going for their fifth consecutive DVOA championship.
By
the way, did you see...
First time DVOA Bowl winners.
No, two-time DVOA Bowl winners.
Oh, who did they beat in the previous DVOA Bowl?
Arizona last year in Week 17. That was the previous
DVOA
Bowl.
Oh, man, that was a huge DVOA Bowl victory.
So last year, Pete Carroll talked about DVOA. And then this year, Doug Baldwin, after the game, I guess, I don't know if he brought it up unsolicited or was asked about it, but he referenced that he liked DVOA and knew that the Seahawks were number two and the Eagles were number one.
And he needed to get there. He also is going to reference that he's going to be in the others on the passing category.
Well, he said that he had a perfect 100 QBR, which I think is true.
A perfect 100 QBR. That's great. We need to have more players from Stanford. We're going to reference their advanced statistics.
Nobody loves advanced stats more than the Seahawks, which is good because advanced stats love the Seahawks.
Yeah, the feeling is mutual.
It is.
But this, we should talk about this game for a second, right?
Okay.
It was a game where we talked about going in, right, that Philadelphia wasn't going to score a lot of points, and they really didn't. They couldn't get a lot going against the Seahawks offense.
Yeah.
But if the Seahawks were able to get things going against that Philadelphia defense, it might portend scary things for the league.
And they got things going.
Lo and behold.
403 yards. I mean, the one unscary thing about it is the role that was played in it by CJ Procise and the fact that he's not going to be around for a while.
Yeah, almost a quarter of those yards.
Fracturing his scapula.
That's an unscary thing, but at the same time, still, I think they could have scored more points, right? They didn't score as many points as 400 yards against the Eagles would indicate.
They left some points on the table in the red zone, as they did last week against New England. And I think if there is a fair criticism of the Seahawks offense over the years, which...
Not enough Doug Baldwin passing.
Which therefore becomes always a criticism of Daryl Bevel. It's that they have not been very good in the red zone. I think one reason is maybe that they're probably more conservative in the red zone than most teams. Pete Carroll's philosophy in Seattle has always tended very conservative, like... lean on the defense. We don't need that many points to win, which was certainly true on a day like last Sunday.
The defense is pretty good.
It was.
But then also the running back position. I mean, the injuries are really... the big takeaways from the game are, first, the amount of yards that they put up against the Eagles.
How good this team is at its best is number one.
But then the injuries...
And number two, the
injuries. On both sides, really. But we're not really concerned with the Eagles going forward. Don't care. Probably not going to see them again.
Yep.
The injuries to the running backs, though, kind of changed the dynamic for the rest of the season.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like Procise most likely back around the start of the playoffs, assuming the Seahawks get there.
Should they make the playoffs?
Yes. And, you know, we haven't seen much of a timetable for Troymaine Pope with his high ankle sprain, but it seems likely to me that the Seahawks will probably put him on IR
to clear up a roster spot. Move on from Troymaine Pope.
Not move on.
I mean, he might be on the roster next year, but for this season,
we've
seen all the Troymaine Pope we're going to see.
It seems likely, and there was talk from Pete Carroll today about the possibility of calling up George Farmer from the practice squad, which would make some sense because the thing you're particularly looking for at this point is a third down back.
Is George Farmer a good third down back?
Well, he's played wide receiver as well as running back, so I assume he's good at catching.
That's what we do. That's who we have as our third down back.
It is. Yes.
I mean, you had mentioned,
and he's going to have to wear number 22. I don't know if that's legal with Procise still on the roster, but all Seahawks third down backs must wear 22.
You'd mentioned the possibility of bringing back C.J. Spiller, which
he's on the New York Jets roster.
Oh, so is he really?
That's not possible.
You keep mentioning players bringing back players who are on other rosters.
Spiller, the Jets picked him up and waived Troymaine Pope to make room for him.
There we go.
That's why Pope was back here. So, yeah, I mean, it's going to have to be pretty much Farmer. I mean, there was some talk about Ronnie Hillman after he got released.
Oh.
But
I guess I'd be okay with that.
I think that's unlikely. That doesn't really seem like the Seahawks' MO.
Pete Carroll said that he was confident with Alex Collins as the backup running back going forward.
Right. So I think that's probably what we're going to see is Rawls, Collins, and then Farmer in maybe a third down back role.
And then the secondary with Earl Thomas and Deshaun Shedd getting injured with very similar injuries.
Yeah, both with hamstrings, and Pete Carroll said today that the timeline in both of those guys is fairly similar, 10 to 14 days, so very unlikely to see them this week in Tampa Bay, which would mean a very different Legion of Boom.
What do you think about, I mean, being at the game, it's hard to tell really how, especially individual defensive players are playing, but except for Bobby Wagner, which, by the way, I feel like Bobby Wagner might, is quietly putting together a defensive player of the year type season.
Stop.
You don't think so?
He's having a great season, but he's not going to win Defensive Player of the
Year. He's not going to win Defensive Player of the Year because it's not flashy.
I don't actually, but I mean, here's an interesting debate, is who has been the Seahawks' best defensive player this year?
Between Sherman.
I mean, you can make a case for Earl Thomas based on his last few weeks.
And well, Earl Thomas had some questionable times. Bobby Wagner at no point has been questionable.
But what about Cliff Avril?
Oh, man.
He's so, had a great season.
I think it's true that Bobby Wagner is leading the league in tackles.
Yes.
And Cliff Avril is leading the league in sacks.
He might be tied. I don't think he's leading outright, is he?
He's tied is the same as leading. But
okay.
Man, that's a tough question.
It is a tough question.
And the real thing is when you see somebody like Cam Chancellor coming back, he wouldn't get the same kind of credit because he hasn't played in every game. But man, seeing his impact has been huge.
Right. You see how much better this team is when it's at full strength defensively.
But so how
which
did
is
you,
a bummer that they're not going to be at full strength.
Just 10 to 14 days. What did it look like for Stephen Terrell and Nico Thorpe playing?
Well, we didn't see them, the Eagles attack Nico Thorpe much because they completed two passes to their wide receivers until the fourth quarter, I believe. They at that point, Russell Wilson had as many receiving yards as the Eagles wide receivers combined.
Yeah, I saw that.
So he didn't get attacked a lot until late in the game, and then I didn't watch all the fourth quarter. I was watching
we're gonna fight right now.
I was watching the Chargers Dolphins game on Red Zone.
You were watching the Chargers Dolphins.
The game was over.
Okay, let's hear some of the thrilling takeaways they had from this Chargers Dolphins game. Let's hear a lot of. Are you doing a podcast about Jared Goff?
Devontae Parker had some really big plays for Miami down the stretch.
Great. Okay, so let's look at Tampa Bay.
Yeah, who is coming off in their own right a really impressive win. I'm not going to say necessarily their most impressive win of the year because they also beat the Falcons. But no, this probably is their most impressive win of the year because everyone was talking last week about how no one was talking about the Chiefs being 17-2 in their last 19 games.
That seems about right.
And had not lost at home in that stretch. And Tampa Bay goes into Arrowhead Stadium and beats the Chiefs 19-17.
We don't have the DVOA for this week, but it kind of made you reconsider what the Tampa Bay Buccaneers are.
I mean, they're very much in the mix in the NFC South at this point.
Oh, for sure. They're a game out.
Yeah.
They're for sure in the mix. And this is probably a more important game to Tampa Bay than it is to Seattle.
Yeah. I mean, I would say that most games are probably going to be like that for the Seahawks if they're non-division games for a while. But, yeah, I mean, every game is very important for Tampa Bay at this point in their season.
So should we talk about their offense first going against the Seahawks defense?
Sure. I mean, Jameis Winston, you know, he started out with a great week one against that Atlanta secondary, which is a little bit questionable, and then slumped for a long period of time. And then people started asking, you know, hey, what's wrong with Jameis Winston? Marcus Mariota was playing so well, and that kind of contrasted poorly with Winston. But now you look up, he's 11th in QBR in his second year. He's one spot ahead of Russell Wilson, which raises some questions about QBR, but also indicates how well he's played.
I mean, Russell's been hurt for a lot of the year.
Yes.
But I think Jameis has really come on lately. And the one thing that I noticed about Tampa Bay, I mean, this is more overall, is they're really average at a lot of things.
Yeah. I mean, we talked about this a few weeks ago, I thought, when we were going against the, which defense was that? That was completely
Buffalo.
Average. Yeah, Buffalo.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's very similar to that with the Buccaneers.
And Jameis is part of that where, okay, so you look at the Buccaneers offense. Jameis, very average.
Although their passing attack has been better than average. So even coming into last week before they torched that Kansas City defense, they were still 12th in passing DVOA. The real issue for them offensively has been the rushing game, which was 30th.
Yeah. Yes.
So they've had a ton of injuries to that position, more even than the Seahawks. Doug Martin, their starter, who they had a huge year last year, they re-signed to a lucrative new contract over the offseason. And he's averaging 2.8 yards per carry.
Okay, so the thing about Tampa Bay is they end up being average because they're so bad at running and pretty good at passing.
Yes,
right?
And they pass a lot more than they run.
But I was going to say, the thing about Tampa Bay is what they lack in running ability, they make up for in rushing attempts. because they they are 6th in the league in rushing attempts and are by far of the teams at the top in rushing attempts, the worst of those teams, averaging 3.7 yards per attempt. Doug Martin looks like one of the worst running backs in the NFL this season. Basically, everybody has been injured. Jacquizz has played pretty well when he has played, but has been injured for, I think, the last 3 weeks.
Yeah, he's had a sprained foot, so he may come back this week, which would help that rushing attack, presumably, although Doug Martin is, I guess, still the starter when you pay him that much money.
Bring it on.
But he had like 20...
I welcomed him to run the ball.
I think he had 24 carries last week. He's probably not going to get that heavy a workload if Rodgers is also in the mix.
And if you look at the thing at the other end of the spectrum, at the offense that Tampa Bay has, that person's name is Mike Evans.
Who also has a lot of usage. He is probably more usage than he has efficiency, but he's been pretty good in his own right in terms of efficiency as well. So he's 7th in DR so far this season. Really a breakout year, kind of what everyone expected from Evans when he had that huge rookie season 2 years ago, playing with a variety of awful quarterbacks. I think it was Josh McCown and Mike Glennon at that point.
First off, Josh McCown is not. He is an average quarterback. Average is not awful.
He was not an average quarterback that season.
Okay. I'm just having number one on the average is not awful bandwagon.
Ryan Fitzpatrick is
Brian Hoyer is great.
Okay, Brian Hoyer is a good one. Josh McCown was not average that year. He was substantially worse than it. So he's kind of the alpha and the omega of the Tampa Bay.
He's the offense.
Yeah, pass game. So they lost Vincent Jackson. He's out for the year. Adam Humphreys has kind of been the security blanket as the slot receiver for Jameis Winston, but really on a per-play basis, he hasn't been that great. The guy who kind of scares me a little bit is Russell Shepard.
Yeah, I kind of like these other guys that they have.
Yeah, he's come on lately. He's had catching 76.5% of the passes thrown his way this year, which is really good. And then Cameron Brate has actually been sneaky good for them at tight end since they released Austin Seferian Jenkins. Happy Apple Cup.
He met his fate as a Husky tight end, as a first or a highly drafted Husky tight end, and that is being released by the Buccaneers. But I kind of like some of the other options that they have. Let's assume that Richard Sherman is going to match up with Mike Evans, and
I think that is a reasonable assumption.
Is going to make it very difficult for him to catch passes. Some of the other options they have between Cecil Shorts and Russell Shepard.
I'm not as enamored of Cecil Shorts this year.
Always like Cecil Shorts.
That's true. I can vouch for that.
Cecil Shorts the third. But some of these other options are not terrible options that they have. And again, Russell Shepard's had a very nice season.
Yeah. So, I mean, I could see Winston working a lot underneath the guys like Brate and Shepard and Humphreys and picking up some third downs that way, extending drives. I mean, I think the what you're hoping for is the Seahawks defense is, you know, completely shutting down the run game when you put an outstanding run defense against this bad run offense, and therefore putting Winston consistently in third and long.
It'll be very curious to see what the Buccaneers offense can do. I mean, there are better weeks that the Seahawks could have Stephen Trell and Nico Thorpe probably starting their first ever games.
Yeah, that's true.
This is not the best option. It's not the worst option, but I think this passing
I mean, I also think, by the way, Jeremy Lane will probably start. Thorpe will probably play on the outside and push Lane to the slot when they go into the nickel, which will be frequently.
But the Buccaneers are not... They don't have big names, right? But they do have some interesting options at receiver outside of Mike Evans. If Sherman just completely takes Mike Evans out of the game, it wouldn't shock me if somebody like Russell Shepard had a nice game.
That wouldn't shock me either.
What about the Seahawks offense going against the Buccaneers defense?
So the Buccaneers defense, as you mentioned, pretty average here. They're number 15 in, and this was before last week against the Chiefs, so they may have gone up a little bit. But number 15 in pass defense DVOA, number 16 in rush defense DVOA. Yeah. That's as average as you can get.
Yeah.
Their adjusted sack rate is average. Their defensive line adjusted line yards, their like defensive line against the run, completely average. The one thing that stands out as not average is the fact that they've really struggled against deep passes.
That was the thing.
Yeah, which is exciting for a Seahawks offense that the last few weeks has been unleashed in terms of throwing the ball downfield.
Unleashed. So they have a very strong linebacking core. They don't let a lot... In the middle of the field, they don't give up a ton, right?
They've particularly Levante David, who I think is the biggest reason
Quan Alexander
great against tight ends.
So they have very good linebackers, but then their secondary, and you look at Brent Grimes is maybe out this week also, one of their starting quarterbacks.
Yeah, he left last week's game with a quad injury. No update as yet. And he was replaced by Alteron Verner, who you'll recall got a lot of money from Tampa Bay as a free agent sign-in from Tennessee and has been a major bust thus far, although he actually apparently played pretty well at Kansas City.
But if you look at big plays, which Pete talks about all the time, right? And you look at the...
I'm sorry, if you want to be a real NFL fan, you got to call them explosives.
You said this last time.
You have to take something that is an adjective and turn it into a noun.
Okay. So if you look at explosives...
Yep.
Tampa Bay gives up a lot of explosive plays.
They don't
generate a ton of explosive plays themselves. But if you look at just explosive plays given up, they currently sit at tied for third in the league with 60 explosive plays against them. Actually tied with Philadelphia.
Yeah. And I think one reason for that is the fact that they don't really get much of an edge rush whatsoever.
And this could be the difference in the game.
Yeah. If you can protect Russell Wilson, and you know the offensive line did a pretty good job last week, especially a remarkable job, I thought, by Reese Odhiambo coming in there for George Fant briefly and holding his own at left tackle, which was unexpected in his first real NFL action.
Yeah, Pete raved about Reese Odhiambo.
Yeah, which made me curious about where he fits in long-term. And yeah, I think like George
why Fant, Reese Odhiambo is not starting. But
I think George Fant is the left tackle for the next 5 years.
What an insane thought.
He hadn't played football before this year. Never played competitive football.
But getting the ball downfield, because Tampa Bay doesn't give up a lot in the intermediate area, right? But passes downfield, this could be a big game. I mean, Doug Baldwin, right, has been able to get open downfield. But it could be the type of game where maybe we finally see Jermaine Kearse get off a little bit.
I was going to say Tyler Lockett.
And might hit a big play to Tyler Lockett.
Yeah.
I think those are the things to really look out for. It might not be a huge Jimmy Graham game. But some of those other receivers may get off here.
I think so.
And that's the thing that makes me feel a little bit better looking at this game, feeling like, okay, it kind of feels like a trap game for the Seahawks. Fortunately, they prepare and they compete in a way that they don't really have trap games.
Yeah.
But if you recall, after Thanksgiving...
Other than the Rams.
Yeah, it's not a trap game. The Rams are just...
Because we know going in, everyone...
There's no trap. It's not a trap.
It just catches us every time.
But if you recall a game that they played in the state of Florida after Thanksgiving.
I do recall that game.
Against the Miami Dolphins. And it was a game that the Seahawks should have won. And it was a huge game. And that was one where you just still look back on it. What are we, 4 years later? And I still look back on that game and think, should have won that game.
I mean, it was a bad omen that year losing the Apple Cup in the fashion that the Huskies did. And it just carried over to the Seahawks. That was a bad weekend.
Man, our podcast was so down that weekend. We really brawled with each other. Killed a man that weekend. But this doesn't feel like that type of game to me.
It feels a little like that type of game to me. Now, here's what gives me hope.
What gives you hope?
How bad Roberto Aguayo is.
Yeah.
Buccaneers traded up in the second round to draft a kicker. Roberto Aguayo from Florida State.
Was he perfect yesterday?
He was perfect yesterday. I think
that's,
he only...
You have to say that's something.
I think he only made... He made four field goals, yeah.
Yeah.
So he's... Yeah, he's, I think, 13 for 18 on the season.
Roberto Aguayo is not about starting strong. Roberto Aguayo is about finishing strong.
Okay. Thanks, Pete.
You know, he's like, the field goals are going to come. Just wait. I might be missing field goals now, but just wait. They're going to come. He's like, I know that he used a second round draft pick on me, but I didn't miss any extra points this week, and that's a lot more than could be said for most teams.
I will give him that.
More only had one attempt, but made it.
More than could be said for the Seahawks, for that matter.
But Roberto Aguayo is a reason that gives you hope.
It is. By the way, you know who else the Seahawks are facing for maybe the first time ever? Maybe the second time?
Who's that?
Brian Anger.
Okay.
I'm remembering this correctly, right? That Brian Anger, yeah, he's the guy who was drafted ahead of Russell Wilson.
Oh, he's the punter.
Yeah.
You can always remember that. Facing a punter who was drafted ahead of Russell Wilson and a kicker who was drafted. Was he drafted in the second round?
He was drafted in the second round.
The state of Florida is really bad at assessing when to take kickers and punters.
Yep.
They must have faced Brian Anger at some point. This couldn't be the first time.
Also, Roberto Aguayo's nickname is Mr. Perfect, which feels ironic.
Mm.
Yeah, I think they did face him once when he was in Jacksonville. So, but the thing is, could Jacksonville really have used Russell Wilson in the last 5 years? No.
They've
been great.
Percentage chances of victory in Tampa Bay?
I would say about 60.
I was going to say 65%.
That's exactly how it should be.
I honestly, it's not the perfect matchup for the Seahawks. And again, there's a thing that's scary about teams that are average at everything.
But that they're not bad at anything other than running in this case.
I mean, what are they going to get running the ball? Basically nothing.
No, that was the point.
Yeah, most of the offense is going to have to happen, and I don't think it's going to come from Mike Evans. This is a game about Russell Shepard and Cecil Shorts and Cameron Brate.
And Adam Humphries.
And Adam Humphries, right? Was he on St. Louis?
No, I think he's only been on Tampa Bay.
Okay. The Vikings? Or is that Adam Thielen that I'm thinking of?
Yes, that okay. is who you're thinking of.
This is a game
about... Adam Humphries is 23. He's definitely only been on Tampa Bay.
About those receivers... I mean, how does Brian Anger? He's been on two teams. This is about those receivers against the Seahawks defense. And that's how Tampa Bay is going to have to generate offense. And I still feel more confident in the Seahawks secondary, despite whomever is out there. I feel more confident in them against those receivers than I do on the other side of Tampa Bay stopping big passes for the Seahawks.
That seems reasonable.
What about the Apple Cup?
Yeah, should we get to the main event here?
Yeah.
So the question I think that's going to be asked all week is this the best Apple Cup matchup ever? The Huskies come in with one loss, top 10 in the country, number 6. The Cougars, even though they come in off a loss to Colorado with only one Pac-12 loss, the Pac-12 North title on the line here, it's probably the most momentous Apple Cup of all time. I think that's safe to say. But I crunched the numbers on whether this is the best the two teams
there
have ever
been. There
we go. And I used sportsreference.com.
Bludgeoning them with numbers.
Yes. Simple rating system, which goes all the way back to like 1916 for the Huskies.
Does it really?
We got a lot of, yeah. Got a lot of history included here. And so I looked at the combined. I thought about doing like some sort of more complicated thing, but it turned out the combined average worked pretty well. And there was one year where the two teams combined to be better than this.
1936.
No. Sadly, like at one point, 1930 was up there, but it turned out I was using 1931 for Wazoo and 1930 for UW, so it was all off. 1997 is the one time that you could plausibly argue these two teams were better. That was, of course, the Ryan Leaf team that went to the Rose Bowl after beating the Huskies in the Apple Cup. And then the other side...
Were they going against Brock Heward?
Yeah, that was Brock Heward's junior year, his last year at UW. And that was a team that had like a ridiculous number of NFL draft picks,
yeah.
Was number 4 in the country to start the year, got as high as number 2 before they lost to Nebraska, and then ended up going 8-4.
Wow.
Partially because Heward got hurt and Marcus Tuiasosopo had to play some of those games as a freshman. But like one of the most underachieving UW teams. Still very good, though. Remarkably, in the Sports Reference simple rating system, UW had the better rating that year than Wazoo.
Really?
Yeah. Because they were like so dominant when they did win, including blowing out Michigan State in the Aloha Bowl in Jim Lambright's final game. Or no, not final game. He coached the next year. Pay no attention. Strike that from the record.
Okay. Well, it'll be officially struck from the record.
Okay. So this is number 2 at a combined 31.4 SRS. And then number 3 is 92, where that's, the of course, the famous Snow Bowl where
Mark
Bledsoe's team.
Oh.
No. Mark Rippian was like in the NFL at that point. He had already won the Super Bowl with
him. I'm just naming every Wazoo player that I'm familiar with.
Drew Bledsoe beat the Huskies in the snow as part of... The team that had kind of collapsed after the notice of inquiry from the NCAA and Billy Hobert getting benched because
he was ineligible. I'm kind of surprised that there wasn't any game because the Wazoo's, not necessarily their peak as a program, but they did have that era in the late 80s between Rippian and Drew Bledsoe where they were really good, and then the Huskies had their peak as a program during that time period.
I never really overlapped. Like in 91 when the Huskies were the co-national champions, that year Wazoo went 4-7.
I mean,
I think the other team, the game that people would point to would be 2003, one of the most memorable Apple Cups.
Oh, no, it's what, Jason Gesser versus Cody Pickett?
Was it 2002?
Where it went to multiple overtimes?
Yeah, Wazoo went 10-3, went to the Rose Bowl that year.
And UW won the Northwest Championship.
They did, but UW was 7-6, so as a result, therefore, not that high. The next two on the list were 91, simply on the strength of the Huskies being so good that year. And then 1977, when UW went 8-4.
I feel like you're just naming years now.
And Wazoo went 6-5, but had a better record than that would indicate.
Okay, so the stakes are very high.
The one thing I did want to note is these two teams have the all-time record for combined UW and Wazoo wins in a season is 18. And so they've already tied that this year.
Really? And somebody has to win this weekend.
Guaranteed will be broken this weekend. Yes. Partially because of the expansion of the schedule.
And then also guaranteeing that somebody's going to play another game.
Yes.
Well, I mean, they're both going to play bowl games, but
somebody will play in the Pac-12 championship out of these two.
But the stakes are definitely higher, right?
Yeah.
And you look at having a Pac-12 North and a Pac-12 South means that the stakes are more likely to be higher.
That is true.
The chance at winning the Pac-12 North, something that both of these schools will be doing for the first time ever.
Yep.
In this Apple Cup, and you have to think back, which before we even talk about this game, can we just reflect for one moment how insane it is that we're even here?
Well, I thought you were going to point out something.
What am I going to point out? How close we are to being 0-12?
No, that you had a bold prediction when we made these last year that UW and Wazoo, the Apple Cup, was going to be for the Pac-12 North title, and you were correct about that.
Look, I don't need to talk about all of my correct bold predictions here. Let's save it for the end of the year.
Yeah,
we're talking about President Rubio. when we're on the precipice.
Elect.
President-elect Rubio.
That'll make sense eventually.
just wait. It's a long play. But the fact that we are, for both of these programs, right? Wazoo is not that far removed from having Paul Wolf as their coach and things looking more or less dire, right?
Yeah.
And then also the Huskies being not that far removed from an 0-12 season. And you look at both programs, don't just look good right now. They look like they are building actual programs for now and the future.
They are poised to, you know, along with, I think Stanford will still be in that mix. And I mean, Oregon's not going to go away. But
I really hope Oregon was going to go away.
They're going to stop playing football. But it looked like Oregon and Stanford were going to dominate the Pac-12 for the foreseeable future. And now the state of Washington has broken through that hegemony that they held.
All of a sudden, Pac-12 belongs to the state of Washington. There we go.
At least the North.
But it's still amazing that we're even at this moment where these two teams are playing for the Pac-12. And you have to look at Wazoo and not just being reliant upon this passing game and a great quarterback on having a defense that's getting better and a running game that's getting better.
That's true.
And everything that they do that is getting better. So let's look at their offense going against the Husky defense.
Can I give you a hot take?
All right, let's hear it.
I think the Cougar passing game is overrated.
Overrated. It's okay. Why do you say that?
Luke Falk is 7th in the Pac-12 in yards per attempt at 7.4 yards per attempt. He is completing 71% of his passes, which that's pretty good if you like that sort of thing. But they're generally, you know, is the air raid is, they're short passes.
Yeah, they're almost running a true West Coast offense.
In some ways, yes. But what's I think gets slept on with the Cougars is that they have three running backs who are averaging around 6 yards per carry each. Jamal Morrow, Gerard Wicks, and James Williams. So that's impressive. I mean, obviously they don't run as much as most teams, but I would say there's more balance to this offense than we're used to in years past.
Yeah, and they're definitely employing the run at more opportune times and getting more from it.
I also think Jamal Morrow is super underrated individually. You know, he leads the Pac-12 running backs in receiving yards, and then, like I said, is getting about 6 yards per carry on the ground. So he's had a really impressive dual threat season.
So you say that the Wazoo passing attack, that Falk is a little bit overrated and their passing attack is overrated. What about their wide receivers?
Well, I think it's a little bit of a question, you know, how good they're going to continue to be without River Craycraft, the senior who, you know, was lost for the season to them. And
I don't think I ever knew his first name. I only knew him as Craycraft. I didn't know that his first name was River.
Well, it's such a boring first name. Who would ever remember that as a player? But, you know, it's tough to separate that last week at Colorado from the fact that Colorado has had arguably the Pac-12's best pass defense this season. But they weren't the same without
better than UW?
I think on a per-play basis, they've actually been somewhat better than UW. I looked at this, but I didn't write that down.
And that's kind of the game that I think the Huskies have to look to as it'll be a tough thing to replicate what Colorado did. But you look at Luke Falk, he's only averaging 7.5 yards per attempt in the Pac-12, which is good for 7th. And in that game, he was down to 6.5 yards per attempt, and their secondary really held the Wazoo passing game in check.
They did. I mean, I think, you know, one thing that was noted on the broadcast was they were continuing to be successful when they were going to their X and Y, the outside receivers, because of the fact that, you know, Gabe Marks, who is still their best receiver, and then Tavarius Martin, those guys are healthy, but it's the slot receivers who are replacing Craycraft, who struggle a little bit with some drops.
What do you make of, as of today, Darren Gardenhire announcing that he's going to be leaving the UW program?
So I don't think it matters too much for this weekend and the rest of the season. You know, Gardenhire was barely playing defensively
at all.
I did too.
I like Darren Gardenhire.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's more of a concern long term because you looked at him next year stepping in with Kevin King graduating. I think I would be very surprised if Sidney Jones doesn't declare for the NFL draft at this point and take advantage of how high his stock is. So the Huskies could be looking at replacing both of their outside cornerbacks. And, you know, I think that certainly Gardenhire was in line for one of those spots. He also had a great special teams week last week against Arizona State.
I just like everything about Darren Gardenhire. I think it was sad to see him go. At the very least, he is a professional cornerback.
I don't know if that's the phrase I would use, but
he's experienced and knows what he's doing,
yes.
Right? He's not going to F anything up too badly. Who was it who we saw for UW, one of the younger corners who played last week?
Miller.
Oh, Jordan Miller or something like that, yeah.
So he was like he's in line to start next year. I think he because he's been playing as a sophomore, but Gardenhire was as well. So that
man, it's a tough loss losing Darren Gardenhire. Okay, so what about?
But the Huskies have lost better quarterbacks midseason than still adjusted.
Never heard of him.
there's a reference to Marcus Peters, by the way, for those of you who didn't get that.
What about the UW offense going against Wazoo's defense?
So, as you mentioned, the defense has really improved the last couple seasons under Alex Grinch, their new defensive coordinator, and I think that's really the reason that the Cougars have become so much more competitive. I mean, they've always been able to move the ball, at least when their starting quarterback is healthy, which that's been an issue under Mike Leach, but, you know, the air raid offense is going to move the ball, and it's a question of whether they can get any kind of stops defensively, and they have so far this year. I mean, I think the one thing that remains a weakness for them is their pass defense. They're giving up 7.8 yards per attempt. So they're actually allowing more yards per pass attempt than they get offensively.
That's crazy.
Which is kind of hard to believe. They make up for that, number one, the fact that that's more, you know, it's more consistent on offense with the 71% completions. Mm-hmm. And then also their rush defense has been pretty strong.
Who do they have on rush defense?
I mean, it's
my
more
dude,
or less a team of
Hercules Mata'afa.
That's who you're giving the credit?
I mean, they also Shalom.
Shalom Luani at safety, yeah. And then Robert Barber, who has been in and out of the lineup a little bit because of his legal issues. I mean, he's been able to play.
he's a Wazoo player, after all. Times aren't that different.
So that's a more complex conversation than we have the time to get into on this podcast. Policing in Pullman, Washington is its own entire separate issue.
But I believe Hercules Mata'afa is leading the team in tackles for loss at 11 and has looked like a disturbing force on the Wazoo defensive line.
Yeah, which is a lot of run tackles for loss because they don't have anyone with more than 3 sacks. I mean, he leads them with 3.
And then also Peyton Pelur, who I think is Cooper's brother. Is that true?
Might be cousin. But
cousin?
Definitely
how many
related.
Pelurs could there possibly be?
There's a lot of Pelurs out there.
Are there? In the state of Washington?
Yeah.
In the great football state of Washington?
I mean, there's Scott.
Oh, yeah, Scott Pelur.
Yeah.
Wait, who's Scott Pelur?
He's a coach.
Okay. Wait, is he the coach of Idaho?
Yeah, he might be.
Okay, I'm pretty sure. If he is, I'm going to be so impressed with myself. You were so sad to admit that I might be right about that. but seeing this Wazoo team have a defense that is even at the level of capable is a game changer for them when they're going to pass the ball and put up so many points.
Yeah. I mean, they don't have to be great. They just have to be good. And I think that's what they've been so far this season. I mean, ESPN's FPI and their efficiency rates them 43rd defensively, which That's good enough.
43rd is not bad.
It's a big improvement for where they were a couple of years ago.
Right? When you have the 16th best offense, you can be the 43rd best defense. And I really think we're judging this Wazoo team. Have you found out whether Scott Blair? This shouldn't be that hard to find out.
Scott was a coach at UW. It doesn't seem like he's coaching right now.
I think that we as a nation, have judged Wazoo worse than they should be. Yeah, I think that they're lower rated and have been throughout the year and are being unfairly judged because of this loss to Eastern, which granted, Eastern is a good FBS team. FCS team? They're a good FCS team.
FCS team, yes.
Eastern is a good FCS team. The Huskies could have easily lost to them three seasons ago. And also, it's week one. You're still figuring stuff out, right? The Husky basketball team just lost to Yale.
Yeah, well, we're not sure yet that that's an outlier. So let's not rule that in the outlier camp just yet. But yes, I mean, there's a tradition of this now at Wazoo where they lose the first week
it's
of the season.
Called cooging it. They cooged it early.
I mean, we've got a name for it, yes. Where they lose week one of the season. In this case, week two, a very explainable loss on the road at a very good Boise State team.
Yes. It was a good loss. And then they didn't lose all the way until facing, again, a top 10 Colorado team on the road, which you wouldn't expect Wazoo to beat.
But yeah, I mean, you're right in terms of the advanced stats. If you look at, FPI has the Cougars rated 15th in the country.
That feels about right.
Which that, I don't believe, takes into account the loss to Eastern Washington because they don't factor in matchups against FCS. The Sagarin ratings do factor that in, and they have Washington State at 17th. No, 13th, actually, in the predictor.
They feel like they're in around the 15th best team in the country, right?
Yeah.
I think we can agree with that.
And they're ranked 23rd at this point.
And so we're looking at a team that beat Stanford by almost 30 points, right?
That's true.
In Stanford. That's not an easy victory. A team that beat an Arizona team that the Huskies struggled with by over 60 points.
That is also true. I mean, but we're also looking at a team that beat UCLA by 6 with falafel at quarterback, Mike Faithful. They were at Arizona State, won that game by 5, at Oregon State by 4. So I would say
they're not playing this game on the road.
They've been a less consistent team than UW has over the course of the season.
Sure. I mean, they're a worse team than UW is over the season and currently. Talent-wise, they are a worse team than UW.
Yes.
But they are hosting this game, and they could present some problems for UW.
Yeah.
So I don't think we can go into this assuming that the Huskies are an overwhelming favorite. And I actually think the spread at being around 6-7 points felt a little bit high to me.
Well, it's interesting. It opened at 6 and then dropped to 4.5. On Sunday, when I first went to go put together these notes on Sunday, it was 4.5. And then I updated them Monday night, and by that point, it had climbed back to 6. So I think 4.5 is a fairer representation of where these two teams are.
It feels about right. And it's the type of game where, I mean, UW, they're the favorites. I feel good about it. And I look at last week, what UW did pressuring the quarterback, bringing kind of a lot of different blitzes.
Yeah, should we talk about that a little bit? Because that was the biggest weakness of this team, you know, in the loss to USC, and then previous to that, even since Joe Mathis was injured, and then all of a sudden it reversed itself quite dramatically against Arizona State, which is not completely surprising given ASU's talent, but still was notable.
It was notable, but also I feel like we noted Arizona State figured it out at some point, and Wazoo's going to figure it out quickly. First off, it's on tape.
It is. Which I don't know if it's a good thing, because at least you're forcing them to prepare for. So what we saw specifically was not necessarily a lot of pressure from the linebacking core, but we saw a lot of edge blitzes, particularly from Buda Baker.
Tevis Bartlett did have 3 sacks.
Yeah, but I think a lot of those, even when Tevis Bartlett had sacks, it was created by pressure from blitzes.
It'll be
also Tevis Bartlett had 3 sacks. Wow, yeah,
Tevis Bartlett, maybe not that bad.
better than Connor O'Brien.
I don't like Connor O'Brien. I mean, sure, he's fine. He'll be a good player, but
I don't think you've graded tape on Connor O'Brien.
I grade him like a 73.2. Connor O'Brien is a very big drop off from Joe Mathis.
Yes, understandably so.
But it'll be interesting to see how they bring pressure in this game.
Yes,
and if Wazoo can't figure it out, then it's going to be a big victory for UW.
But you can't let Luke Falk just sit back there and pick you apart, because he will find open receivers and he will complete those passes.
At the same time, if he realizes, okay, pressure is coming from here, I'm going to throw it there, right?
Yeah. So that's why I think you have to disguise things.
Yeah.
You know, I think there was at least one delayed blitz from, I think that was Buda Baker at that point, that was very successful for UW.
This is going to have to be a game where they're going to throw everything at the wall, right? Everything UW has, they have to play it in this game.
No, for sure.
Especially pressure-wise, this is it. They can't save anything. And the stakes are so high. And also, they're playing against, no matter who they were to play, they can't even factor in next week. Next week.
There is no guarantee of next week.
Yes. The best that they have to put out there. They can get pressure. If they can stop the run, I think UW is able to win this game easily.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the thing that gives me the most hope, is the possibility that if UW can be effective, you know, in its nickel defense without kind of selling out against the run, if they can take the run away and make Wazoo one-dimensional, I think that's a big edge for them.
So, percentage chances of victory and winning the Pac-12 North. Percentage chances of talking about another football game for the Huskies next week.
So the listeners can't tell the bitter beer face that I am currently making about having to...
The beer is not bitter, though.
It's not because of the beer. It's because of having to predict the chances of victory in this game. I'm going to go 55.
I was going to go 55 also.
Oh, wow.
Wow! We started out fighting. Yeah, not actually.
We've come together.
And I've agreed that the Huskies have a slightly better than a 50% chance of victory.
I mean, it definitely worries me. I got to look up the forecast for Pullman. It was not for snow last I looked at that, but we need to check that out.
Because this is a two-looking up forecast podcast.
It's got to feel like a snowball kind of game.
It's not a good podcast unless you look up to see if there's snow forecasted in two different cities.
I mean, it's that time of year. The weather plays a big factor. The forecast is 41 degrees and chance of rain, so looking okay at this point.
Yeah, we can handle that.
We can handle that.
And I actually think that UW's passing attack is pretty well suited. I mean, you look at Colorado was able to gain 600 plus yards against Wazoo.
Yeah, and maybe that's the other thing we should be considering is, you know, Colorado was very effective moving the football. And consistently, like the way they were able to run out the clock with these, you know, extended drives in the fourth quarter.
And Sifo Lifau presents some...
You want to try and pronounce that again?
That's my best pronunciation.
Sifo Lifau?
Okay, that's close enough.
All right.
He presents some things that Jake Browning doesn't. Obviously, that's Jake true. Browning is a more efficient passer than he is. But the run game from the quarterback is not necessarily there from Jake.
It's good news for the Huskies. It's definitely not there from Luke Falk.
Yeah. But Jake Browning is not going to run for 100 yards in this game.
No.
And so they're going to have to get their yardage in different ways. At the same time, I just really think that this UW offense is going to move the ball. Like, that ain't USC on the other side of the field.
It is not. I mean, one thing I'm curious about, by the way, is the special teams in this game. The Huskies' special teams have not been as great the last few weeks.
Yeah, what's Coach Pete doing?
It's very un-Coach Pete in that regard. But Wazoo's bad special teams, I feel like, are sort of a blessing and a curse.
Wazoo's bad special teams.
Like, no, they're bad. They're averaging a...
Mike Leach is wholly unconcerned. He is as unconcerned with special teams as Coach Pete is concerned with special teams.
That's fair.
Yeah.
And both Coach Pete's for that matter. But so the fact that Eric Powell, their kicker, is 5 of 10 on field goals this year, it also means he's only attempted 10 field goals. So like accidentally they've stumbled into doing an optimal strategy of going for it on fourth down all the time. They also punt the fewest times of anyone in the Pac-12. Yep. So, like, there's going to be a lot of key fourth downs in this game, I guess, is my takeaway.
Yeah, sometimes being bad can be good.
If you're bad in the right areas.
Yeah.
Because teams kick too many field goals and punt too often. So if you have really bad special teams, you aren't tempted to do that. Mike Leach is a genius, is what I'm trying to tell you.
Wow. Hot take. Hot take to end this episode.
Well, I mean, that was not a hot take like 7 years ago. That was pretty much conventional wisdom. I definitely wanted UW to hire him when we hired Sark.
Man.
100% wanted Mike Leach. Then I found out some more about his personal views, and I'm okay with not hiring Mike Leach.
Yeah,
but
you might be familiar with
he's a good football
law firm
coach
that defended him against Adam James.
He's a great football coach.
So we'll be back on Friday afternoon.
Instead of, are we guaranteeing this win or lose?
Can't say. We might be back.
I mean, it would be a jinx to say that we were going to be back and say it was not going to be win.
I would say that it'll be either way.
Okay.
Right? We can handle a sad cast.
There's going to be things to
We've
reflect on.
We've dealt with defeat. We can handle it.
I mean, the Seahawks lost a Super Bowl in the final play. Like, it's not going to get worse than that.
Yeah. We're not going to be expecting to win the Super Bowl for the second time against Bill Belichick and Tom Brady. So we can handle that. And then we'll just preview the El Paso Bowl that the Huskies are going to go to.
It's not the El Paso Bowl. It's not even the real bowl. It's the Sun Bowl. It's played in El Paso.
Sorry. We'll preview the Sun Bowl. Is there still a Las Vegas Bowl?
I think so.
That's what they're going to. Okay. Sorry, the Emerald Bowl. We'll preview the Emerald Bowl. They're going to be playing against New Mexico State after they lose this game. Can't wait. I feel like percentage chance of victory are going to be really high against New Mexico State.
Yeah, they'll be heavy favorites.
What team did Jeff Tedford go to? Maybe they'll play them.
Fresno State. Yeah. I don't think they're bowl eligible. I believe they may be like 1-11.
Somehow we'll find a way to play them in the San Francisco Bowl after the Huskies lose this game. You know that's what's coming.
Sure.
Okay.
On that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.